Welcome to the third installment of our series on debunking MythVision's documentary called Yahweh, God Takes No Pity, here on Mystic Skeptics Raiders of the Unknown. My co-host Tony and I will keep going through this documentary, which is quite controversial, but Tony and I were just discussing it actually has some type of strange thing that is happening in all the programs that the host and creator of these videos is doing. Tony was sharing that in some ways he's a seeker, as someone who's trying to find answers and trying to make heads or tails of the biblical narratives, both in the Old and New Testament. And in other ways, he is an ardent atheist trying to debunk and destroy everything that Western civilization is built upon. There was a point when I started debating some of his followers, and it seemed that a lot of the names and titles and things that he was doing took a turn. It went from truly wanting to find out the information that needs to be known and promulgated among the people. You know, what really happened? Is this text even reliable? And things like that. And then suddenly became sensationalistic. And a lot of the videos and images became very aggressive towards theistic individuals. Tony, tell me about what you've seen in the interviews with James Tabor and other scholars that we've had on our show. What is Derek's approach? Because that was something that I debated with one of his followers, is how can you say that he has a bias and that he's trying to stir up scholars to say what he wants them to say when these are the scholars speaking for themselves? Do you see that there's like a maneuvering that he does and kind of setting up the narrative to fall within his mindset, or is he truly just asking questions and trying to find the truth?
Well, first of all, he puts on a persona like you watch. I've gone through numerous of his videos, and I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. And when I watch his videos, it almost appears as if he's one of these truth seekers that's always trying to, look at the hard questions, ask the hard questions, look in texts that aren't really considered scripture by any set religious group, to seek for deeper matters. And from that aspect, I grew fond of him because he was asking questions that most religious people kind of shy away from. But then on the other aspect, I see this video that we're going through, and it's confusing. It throws mixed signals because you're like, well, what does this guy believe? I mean, is your on one hand, it's is are you just trying to correct? Because from the videos we see from the scholars that he has on his show, which I admire myself, I admire Dr. Tabor and Bart Ehrman and some of these other guys. Not everything, but there are valid points that they make that are, what's the old phrase? Eat the meat, spit out the bones. So you see this going through, and it's like when he talks to these people, he asks questions as if he's genuinely interested, so he can kind of like get through the fluff and try to set down a good solid foundation of what the early Jesus movement truly taught, what their views were, and the different groups of the sectarian groups amongst them. But then this video shows up, and you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. It's almost as if it does. I mean, your statements are correct from that perspective because you put off one perspective. And then you make just like a hit piece against anybody who believes in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's like, this is so confusing because even some of the scholars he's interviewed, they might not be self-professing Christians, but they still acknowledge God, maybe in a Noahide view or a Geratoshab, whatever their views may be. They're still acknowledging deity, that there is a deity, there is a creator. So, and like David, I mean, James Tabor is one of them. I mean, I don't pertainly, expressly view the same things he views, but I respect his work because you can really tell when you listen to him, he's coming from an unbiased perspective and he's really trying to get to the heart of the matter. People like this, I mean, we've already gone through almost half of it and we've already seen some things that I don't really think he's really thought through logically. And another question would be, if you want to get into matters of Tanakh, why don't you go, instead of to the Christian scholars, why don't you go to Jewish scholars? I just don't understand that. Why do you solely rely upon scholars that focus specifically in the realm of Christian theology? Why don't you interview some well-known prominent rabbis and ask them questions about the Tanakh? You would think that they've had it longer than the Christians, so why wouldn't you ask questions to them to try to probe? Because I know he keeps bringing up these ideas in here, and he keeps saying the age-old responses of how they, like, right, what's the title for this? Justifications for Divine Violence. Well, why don't you consider the source of where these texts come from? The people that have held it dear and kept it for so long to get better understanding. I mean, it goes back to the old logic in my mind. You know, if I need a plumber, I don't go to a doctor. You know, if I need a mechanic, I don't call a carpenter. So it's like, go to the people that have the longest standing tradition up from the texts. So yeah, it's very confusing. It's like, do you believe in God or do you not? What is your motives? Are you trying to destroy the faith of other people that their faith has led to them to live more moral and ethical lives? Because at the end of the day, if you don't accept an ideology or a religion, I mean, that's your personal view. You don't have to go, you know, destroying the faith of anybody else that has caused them to maybe, you know, stop doing drugs or stop robbing people or stop doing negative things. You know, if we break down to the bare minimum, the bare bones of everything, the one thing that I bring up Rav Asher Meza up on this point, and I think he solidifies this perfectly when he speaks with atheists and agnostics a lot. He's like, religion has completely shaped the world that we live in, whether you want to acknowledge it or not, and your very own morals and values are not your own. They've been shaped by the societies you were born into, and you have not, you know, you weren't born, lived in a cave, came out of the cave, had no outside influence from any of the nations of the world, which have been influenced morally and ethically by Christian and Jewish principles and values. You know, it's intellectually dishonest to act like you just reject God, but then you have your own sets of morals and values somehow, like you made it all up yourself. And so it's really intellectually dishonest with these people when they do things like this, because it's like they're biting the hand that feeds them, per se. You know, we've progressed, so let's crap on everybody prior to us. You know, we're standing on the backs of giants here, people that have made leaps and bounds towards civilizing the known world. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine earlier about how, like, though I'm not a self-proclaiming Christian, I do acknowledge the good Christianity's done for the world. They have done had a big hand in civilizing the world, and that is a fact. And for anybody to completely to disagree with that, I mean, you're just igno it's cognitive dissonance. I mean, it's evident. So I would rather be living in a religious society rather than a non-religious society any day. And I mean, I believe all religious people feel the same way as well. Not, and I don't, you know, I've even asked Jews, would you rather live in a Christian society or an all atheistic society? And they say most, for the most part, a Christian society.
Well, before we get too much into the weeds and watch a or play a section of the documentary, I just also want to say that they don't have to be religious Jews that help us, understand the Hebrew scriptures. I studied under both secular and religious professors, and they gave us a wide range of understanding of how these texts came about, what was the purpose of them, how people have interpreted them throughout history. There's a lot of elements that are not being brought into the table when someone just reads the text directly. And then our own biases and our own misunderstanding of ancient cultures is apparent in this video. It's very important what you say, that there's a pastor in Canada that we might be discussing in the future, which makes this huge dichotomy between Judaism and Christianity. And what he really shows is that he's not even a devout Christian like he thinks, that he's more of a Gnostic dualist who's trying to pin Jesus against the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we see a lot of this happening in this particular video from MythVision. So if you already have a twisted version of Christianity, and then you're trying to save that or create a new version of it, then the first thing that you're going to try to knock down is Judaism or the biblical record, because the biblical record is built upon, that's what traditional Christianity is built upon. So if you don't like traditional Christianity and you're already heretical within their context, then of course you're going to come after the framework that brought about that perspective, because you're creating something new. And so it seems like there's a pandemic of biblical illiteracy and religious free-for-all within Christianity, and that's why they don't want to tackle the Jewish question. It just always goes back to that. They don't want to tackle how did Jews disseminate this? What were they trying to say? What is the appeal or the application of these Jewish texts into the Christian lifestyle and perspective? And it's not about beliefs. It's about grounding the religion on a more ancient tradition. Since they don't want to do that, then they go off on all these tangents. And maybe he's trying to save Christianity by talking to all these Christian scholars, but he's not willing to touch Judaism. Or if he does it in this kind of dismissive attitude against it. And it's pretty much de-Judaizing Jesus, because everything that is discussed in the Tanakh is discussed by Jesus. And he has a very traditional and even apocalyptic approach. So we need to get to the point of this documentary where he starts talking about apocalyptic Judaism and see how he rejects that. And maybe that's what he's trying to do, talking to these scholars, like, I don't want an apocalyptic Jesus. I don't want a Jesus who sees the vision of God as the prophets and the writers of the Apocrypha. I want a Jesus that it is pretty much neutralized and sanitized, which all he talks about is love and forgiveness. And then the Old Testament has no relevance or input on what Jesus was saying. So then he's reinterpreting Jesus to make him more modern, and he's throwing the whole Bible out. So then Jesus has really nothing to say. Like he becomes reflection of this particular guy's view of what God is, which is really the problem. So maybe we're being too harsh, but that's pretty much what happens all the time. And we'll see it as we go further with this video.
A name that often simply designates people that live in the land of Canaan would not receive retribution prematurely. Dr. Winham agrees. Here the Amorites stand for all the inhabitants of Canaan. Divine judgment in the form of Israel's conquest must wait until they are sufficiently wicked to deserve this fate. Similarly, Dr. Hamilton summarizes. Only when the iniquity of the Amorites, like the pre-Israelite inhabitants of Palestine, has run its full measure, will the Israelites enter Palestine to claim it and possess it. Only when the iniquity of the Amorites has reached the point of no return will they forfeit the land.
Do you notice how anachronistic and ridiculous it is to implant the Palestinian plight on the ancient Canaanites? I want to stop everything right now, and my co-host Tony might disagree and even feel that I'm plotting against him and against most people who support Israel with no caveats. But I can say that the issue that is going on right now in the state of Israel and with the population of Gaza is what's stirring up a lot of these videos and a lot of these sentiment of disappointment and sadness towards a Jewish perspective, going back even 3,500 years, as we've been discussing. So what people forget is that Jews, like any other human being, has the capacity to make mistakes, has the capacity to have their own independent state, has the capacity to pick political leaders that either benefit or work against their interests, that has the capacity to fight wars and make mistakes, has the capacity to sin and misbehave, cause damage, hurt others, just like they have the capacity to do good and bring a blessing to the world. So the way that people judge Jews throughout history, it's either by a too high of a standard where we're not allowed to make any mistake, or by condemning us and demonizing us that everything we do is screwed up. So then when something like a war takes place, or the way that it's been described by the UN and other countries and agencies as some type of siege or what they would call a humanitarian crisis or war crimes, or however they've been able to depict it based on the evidence they can show, that suddenly everything that these individuals have been doing throughout history or even the past 70 years or whatever is messed up from the get-go. So there's already a conspiracy that there's a group of people who are trying to cause some type of damage, and that damage creates havoc for the world and that specific area of the world. So this is, our conversation here can be very painful and very difficult for people who are already one side in or out regarding the conflict. But unless you understand what was going on back then, unless you understand the many different approaches that people have towards warfare and conquest and dealing with different groups and counterattacks and guerrilla warfare and stuff like that, all of it, you end up making very quick judgments and very quick assessments of who's right, who's wrong, who are the good guys, who are the bad guys. And nothing in history has ever been that simple. There are stories where a Nazi marries a Jew and they have a child, and the child gets rejected by both the dads and the mom's parents for whatever reason. And then what are you going to do? Can you pick a side? Can you say which side deserves that child to be part of them? Like, that's the kind of stuff that is even brought up in the Bible, where you have two nations fighting within the womb. You have people that hate each other with no reason, people who are trying to oppress or sometimes dominate the other group. And you have all kinds of things back and forth. And you can use those stories and make them analogies for modern day. But that's a creative approach, like we've talked before, but it's also an abusive approach, because then now you are making universal claims based on particular stories. And back then, things were completely different than the way they are now. So I just want to convey that you can be someone who's pro human rights and pro justice, as well as someone who's pro fighting, wars that you consider to be done for the right reason. And then also feel that things are getting out of hand, feel that, there are things to blame on each side. There's so many things that can go within someone's mind and heart as they see things unfold. But to take an ancient narrative and try to apply it, or say that is being used as a justification for whatever group's main claim. And if people want to be honest, both the Muslim and the Jewish religious folks can use these texts to justify what they're doing right now, just like the Christians did during the Crusades. So don't come in and attack one group and say, oh, the reason they're doing this is because they want to be like Joshua and Moses in the conquest of Canaan, because all three groups have used these texts as some type of proof that God is on their side, and they can go and destroy the empire of the Aztecs, or take over the U.S. and kill all the natives, or they can take over the whole world under the sword. So don't say that one particular group has abused the text and used it for their purposes more than another, because all three groups have done it. The question is, if you believe in a God, and if you believe in particular perspective that God is holding people accountable and convicting them of what they should be doing, then they all should also be bowing down to the lessons that can be learned from these texts. Not just the permission that you get to do certain things, but the curses and the challenges and the holding you accountable, which that's where most religious groups skip. They only focus on, like, God told me it's cool, let me go do it. When it says, do it, whatever you do, you have to do it with justice. You have to do it with desire for the well-being of others. And you have to do it in a way that it doesn't cause more destruction, which then you're no longer the hero of the story. You're actually the villain. So let's get to the next part. I know that was a long speech, but I'll let Tony respond in a minute what he thinks about that.
Viewed in a more generous way, Abram would receive the land of Canaan, but Yahweh would be patient with its current inhabitants, giving them every opportunity, even at the expense of his chosen people, to come to their senses and repent. However, it may also be the case that the delay in judgment had nothing to do with potential mercy that might be extended to the inhabitants of the land. Yahweh was simply waiting until there was justification for their destruction. This justification for the conquest extends in the text to passages like Deuteronomy 9, 4 through 5. Moses tells the people as they are preparing to enter the land of Canaan, following this long time gap that had been predicted in Genesis 15, 16, they are going to dispossess and destroy its inhabitants.
Do not say in your heart, when Yahweh your God drives them out away from you, Yahweh brought me in to possess this land because of my righteousness, but it is because of the wickedness of these nations that Yahweh is about to drive them out away from you. It is not because of your righteousness and the uprightness of your heart that you are about to come to possess their land, because of the wickedness of these nations. Yahweh, your God, is about to drive them out away from you, and so that he might fulfill the word that Yahweh swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Deuteronomy 9:45.
So I wish, and I know he's not going to do it, I wish that Derek would stop right there and just think, what does the text just told me? The text told me that if this was a wicked nation that is trying to destroy another group, and that they feel that they have complete free-for-all from God and complete permission to do whatever they want, they would never say what the text says. They would never say, it's not because I'm righteous that this is happening. It's because of the wickedness. They would never say that. They would say, we're so wonderful, we're so amazing, God loves us so much, and these people are filled, and we need to destroy them. So the greatest accusation that is happening right now, and this accusation goes back at least 2,000 years, is that the Jews have a superiority complex, which now is being equated with Nazism, and that they go around telling themselves that everybody who does not bow to them deserves to die. And if you really look at it, that's projection for whatever individual has going on in their heart, because they feel that way, and they see Jews as, you know, subhuman. And I've heard a lot of people say they're a monster would think like that, or a monster would do something like that. Well, you're claiming that these people have a hatred of other individuals by calling them monsters. You're the one who's dehumanizing them while claiming that they're dehumanizing you or your friends. What do you think, Tony?
Yeah, it's definitely projecting. And just like you said, it makes no sense for the text to go on and say, don't think for one second you're entering this land because of your righteousness. So it's like you can clearly see that God is acting in a way as if in he's the divine justice of the earth. He's bringing forth judgment on nations that are just completely out of touch with reality and morals and ethics. And when we get some examples in Leviticus of some of the things that they were doing, and it's disgusting. And no atheist or agnostic on the earth would condone practices of such as these. And they would agree if there was a nation or a people group practicing something similar, that there would need something to be doing. I would even say some even would say there's no hope for them. They need to be unalived to some practices.
Well, hold on, because there was a professor that got in trouble because he was saying that morality is subjective and that there is no morality. So in the extreme side of atheism, there is a sense of anything is as good as anything else, which would undermine their own snap judgment against any group. Because then you can't say, you know, whatever they're doing is wrong, because you just said that there is no morality. So yeah, anything goes. But then they're really quick to attack whatever group they don't like and to demonize them when they themselves don't believe in any type of you know, standard. Now, the idea that somebody who's a mass murderer should die. I've heard left wing folks want to say that not only you give them their human rights and equal access to the law, you go overboard to try to forgive them, accept them, allow them to keep going, whatever it takes to save a life. So they go super extreme with pacifism and even honoring of someone who's completely given themselves over to destruction, which to me seems very self-destructive, because then how can you contain such a force? So I really don't know how anybody, and now it's really easy to be a backseat driver and say, well, I would have never fought against the communists. I would have never fought against the Nazis. I would have never stopped the Crusades. I would have never done this. So then where would we be left at? Let all those people rampant, then where do you stop and how far does it get?
Well, it's also it's also easy for people today to look back into in history to say that would be easy for them to do. But the funny thing is that's not your reality. That's not the world you grew up in. That's not the culture or the society you grew up in. And not just that, when they say morality is subjective, well, show me a tangible example of that, because every time I've seen in recorded history where leaders have been atheistic and they've tried to run some type of communistic or socialistic society, it led to the death of hundreds of millions of people historically. So at the end of the day, they want to act as if religious people are the bad guy. But the real heart of the matter is religion has tamed the beast of man, of humanity. It doesn't matter. You can say religious or not, you're still part of the problem. Regardless, you can try to disassociate yourself out of the religious context and say, oh, that's them. But at the end of the day, you as a human being, regardless of what you believe in, atheist, agnostic, you struggle with the same immoralities and unjust and unethical practices of every other human being. Only difference between religious people is we acknowledge it and we try to do something about it. That's the only difference.
Well, let's keep going. We've still got a long ways to go.
Text is clear. You are not getting this land from its current inhabitants because you were somehow deserving of it, having been so righteous and pure of heart. No. It was instead the exceptional wickedness of the inhabitants that was about to result in their expulsion and extermination by Yahweh. Dr. Lundbaum explains. Here begins Deuteronomy's great teaching about the basis on which the conquest will rest. Success will come first of all because the inhabitants of Canaan are full up with wickedness. Abraham was told, when Yahweh made up a covenant with him, that his descendants would not return to Canaan for four generations, because the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet complete. Genesis 15:16. Several other passages go on to bolster this view of justification for Yahweh's actions in the conquest that the reader may find of interest for further investigation. For example, Leviticus 18:24-28 and Amos 2:9. But what we have covered to this point will suffice. It is to this defense that Christians and apologists will often go first. Dr. Hector Avalos writes, if we consider more carefully the outright defense of Hebrew violence, we also see that it can be subdivided into at least two categories. One type of defense relies on frankly theological explanations, as does Gleason Archer. Just as the wise surgeon removes dangerous cancer from the patient's body by use of the scalpel, so God employed the Israelites to remove such dangerous malignancy from human society. Dr. John Collins agrees. In Genesis 15:16, God promises the land to Abraham, but not immediately, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. This single verse is cited to show that the eventual expulsion of the Canaanites was justified by their sinning. But what of this justification defense? What are the central problems with adopting this position? Collins' statement above suggests perhaps the most problematic aspect to the argument. Genesis 15:16 is but a single verse, and there is little to no support for such claims regarding Canaanite culture and society For example, as Dr. Joshua Bowen writes in Chapter 3 of Volume 1 of the Atheist Handbook to the Old Testament, the claims of widespread child sacrifice cannot be substantiated by the evidence outside of the biblical text. To condemn the Canaanites and justify the actions of Yahweh, one must simply take the text of the Old Testament at face value, sometimes to the exclusion of all other sources. Of course, this is an incredibly problematic position to hold. While we could certainly focus on the historical problems with these parts of the Hebrew Bible, I would instead prefer to address this position from a slightly different angle. In the rest of this section, we will look at some of the justifications for divine violence and genocide that apologists use, directing them instead towards atrocities committed by other ancient Near Eastern rulers, specifically Syrian kings. When examined...
On Bill Maher just last Friday, Beto O'Rourke was saying, if it's not so many people who have died in Gaza, let's say it's 1,000 less, let's say that it's 10,000 less, it's still one is too many, according to his view of what's happening. Speaking of collateral damage or innocent civilians, this guy is saying that the exaggeration from the prophets that there was widespread child sacrifice is not congruent with historical realities. If you do an excavation and you can only find that they killed two kids versus killing thousands, so is two kids too many? So let's say that the biblical text, which only comes from one perspective, goes overboard in making that an issue. One child that dies by sacrifice to the gods is too many in the eyes of the Hebrews. So they're willing to make a big issue about Hebrew violence, saying that the Hebrews did all the violence, but now they're minimizing the violence of the Canaanites, which shows a complete bias, especially if you're quoting the atheist guide to the Old Testament. So you're trying to flip the blame, which again, you're doing to a text that has one person's perspective of what happened, trying to make a theological point. So, Tony, what do you think about what I just brought up?
Well, I think it's just one-sided. When you look at things, things are very nuanced and complex. And when you talk about things so black and white, I mean, first of all, where were you during the Iraqi freedom? You know, all these people out here going on, Bill Maher, and it's a hot topic subject right now, right? It's going to get views. It's going to get this, you know. Israel is a big topic amongst all religious groups. Of course they know this is going to bring in attention. And so, I just see all this falling into the same old adage that's been going on for 2,000 years. You know, what I call the voice in the darkness out here spreading lies against Jews. Now, granted, are there immoral Jews in the world? I'm sure there are. Nobody's perfect. But do the Jewish people have a right to exist? Absolutely. Did what happened on October 7th, did that deserve to happen? Absolutely not. There's no justification for that. And the funny thing is these people, they sit here and try to justify for the Palestinians, but what about for the Jewish people? What about their injustice? What about's going on with them? And so this isn't really a religious matter. There might be religious influence, but neither of the texts of either side of these people's groups are telling them to murder these people. There's no Jews actively trying to run the world. There's no Jews out here trying to create some type of Sicari group to overthrow Rome, if you will, or to kill Christians and Muslims. That's not the case. And so it's just a popular thing to hate on Israel. I see that. And back to what you said earlier, I understand the state of Israel is a secular state. And I believe that's done more harm to Judaism as a whole than good. But I do believe Israel belongs to the Jewish people, and they do deserve to exist, and they do deserve to have a place to worship God and practice their faith without being attacked by anybody for any reason. because of an ideology, a difference of opinion on something. I don't know. I mean, it's 2024. We've progressed past these things. You know, I thought we lived in the world of the age of information, where we can sit down and talk about our differences and no longer battle with the sword. But unfortunately, and so my question to all the people that are trying to go to all these news outlets and make all these bold statements that you're making, where were you when those kids in Iraq or Pakistan, wherever it was, got blown up by a drone playing soccer in a field during the Iraqi Freedom War? Nobody was protesting that. Nobody was protesting the innocent lives of the Afghanistans and the Iraqi peoples that were innocent, that had no beef in the conflict. They're just civilians. Nobody was protesting that. But all of a sudden, Jews get involved. Everybody has an opinion. I just think the world just needs to mind their business, allow Jews to do their thing, and let the rest of the world do your thing. If you don't believe in God, stay in your lane. You know, show that you're more moral and ethical than all these other people. Instead of just going on the internet, making hit pieces and making documentaries about our God and this and that, why not show us that you're more moral and ethical than us? Why don't you do that? Or do you just not have an argument to prove with your morals and your ethics? Because I see these people being hypocrites themselves.
Well, and you make an important point, Tony. If someone, the only measurement for truth is science, and this is where the documentary is finally going, they're going to use the archaeological record. And they say, well, archaeology doesn't show that anything in the Bible was true. And there's a couple of Israeli scholars who support this idea. Then science doesn't give you morality. Science doesn't give you perspective on the possibilities of the best approach versus the worst approach, because science focuses on a different theme. And the theme is, what can you prove? So if you use science to deal with a murderer, you can come up with 1,000 ways to justify that murder. And that's what they're accusing religious people of doing. They're accusing religious people of using sophistry, theological manipulation, and twisting of reality to prove that whoever was in charge at that time, who killed a bunch of people, was okay. And if their leader of whatever nation they support does it, then it's also okay. I've heard people try to justify the dictator of Venezuela, or try to justify Castro. And I'm like, so you're willing to justify a modern monster in your own eyes, someone who has stayed in power relentlessly, and then say, well, they keep getting elected, so they must be a good guy, when you know that the elections are being manipulated and that if you vote against them, they kill you? So it's okay to use your measurement of what's right and what's wrong to justify some type of other political perspective that is different from what most people agree with. And then you would turn around and judge harshly a king of Israel, or a judge, or the founder of Judaism, Moses, when you're willing to do that for your leader because you agree with their perspective. So if you take all political perspectives aside and you only focus on science, then all you can say is, we are animals and we dominate each other, and that's it. So then, and you can't judge it because every animal does that. So now you're back at zero. You can only handle the people around you, and you can only push whatever idea from the people that might listen to you. But at the end, your ideas are as silly as anybody else's. So then why make a living trying to knock down someone else's ideas, if your ideas are as silly or as wonderful as anybody else's? And then they say, well, because they've caused so much harm. And it's like, okay, so now you're going to go throughout history and try to pinpoint all the issues with one historical group interpreting an ancient text for their own benefit, which to me is a futile thing, because then you can have 10 other people who interpret it in a positive way, and they helped a lot of people out. If you watch a movie like The Mission, There was monks who were enslaving the natives of the Amazon, and there was monks who were joining them and fighting against the other monks with the Spanish and the Portuguese. So then who was right? In our modern perspective, it was the ones that were siding with the natives. But back then, they thought they were right because they felt threatened by the natives. So in a similar way, whoever is writing these texts, they're saying that they feel threatened by the inhabitants of this land, which either was theirs originally, or they took it over because there was nothing to eat in Egypt, or they came from Sumeria because they got kicked out over there. So now you're getting involved in a geopolitical conflict that happened 3,500 years ago, and you're taking sides just like they were taking sides. So it just goes round and round and round if you don't have an objective source of morality. And the atheists really have very little to push other than whatever philosophy they've already agreed with. So let's see what they say about the other kings who were also slaughtering people, according to this documentary.
These ancient Near Eastern sources, we will be asking ourselves whether the arguments in these texts should be considered reasonable and convincing justifications for sanctioning unchecked state-sponsored violence. In other words, if the Assyrian kings are depicted as carrying out holy war against foreign nations at the command of their deity because of the rebelliousness of these foreign people groups, would we accept this as a justification for such violence? Let's begin with a brief description of how the Assyrian rulers viewed their role when it came to military conquest. Central to this discussion is taking careful note of the distinction between the Assyrian state, Syria proper, and the countries that lie outside of that primary land of Assyria. Dr. Postgate labeled these regions as the land of Assur and the yoke of Assur. Essentially, the main part of Assyria, the core, was to be expanded under the leadership of the king, who was appointed and mandated by the god Assur. Dr. Postgate says it in this way.
The formal pronouncements of the Assyrian kings distinguish between territory directly administered and incorporated within the land of Assur, and areas acknowledging Assyrian domination but retaining some form of autonomy.
This idea of territorial expansion commanded by the deity is described by Dr. Liverani.
So the king acts as a proxy for the deity by divine mandate.
Rest is undertaken on behalf of and by command of the god. It's the Assyrian god, and justified the use of violence for the sake of correction. Notice the reason for regarding a rebellious vassal as sinful or worthy of violent retribution is not simply that they are foreigners or the other. Rather, they had sinned by breaking the oath and inasmuch rebelling against Assur. Dr. Crouch argues,
it is crucial, however, that the sin or wickedness of the Assyrians' enemies is not perceived in a purely abstract sense. That is, that by originating outside of the geographical bounds of Assyria, a person is always or inherently evil, nor as something invented as and when convenient for the sake of political expediency. Rather, the enemy's characterization as wicked is tied to the enemy's own acts.
In addition to the transgression of breaking a loyalty oath, Assyrian texts speak of foreigners plotting outright attacks against the state of Assyria. Dr. Liverani writes,
there is a particular emphasis on two motifs that feature with increasing frequency, the coalition of the many enemies against Assyria alone, and the ingratitude of the enemies who do not appreciate the benefits of central government and who requite good with evil.
By way of example, let's take a look at a well-known literary text, the Tukulti-Ninurta epic. Tukulti-Ninurta I, an Assyrian king of the 13th century BCE, fights against the Kassite king, Kashtiliash IV, who had rebelled against the oath that he swore before the gods.
The gods became angry at the king of the Kassites' betrayal of the emblem of Shamash against the transgressor of the oath, Kashtiliash.
Later in a fragmentary section, we see numerous charges of wrongdoing on the part of the Kassite king.
Falsehood, crime, repression, wrongdoing, the weighty, the divine oath, and went back on what he swore. The gods were watching his furtive deed. Though he was their follower, the king of the Kassites made light of what he swore. He committed a crime, an act of malice.
Tukulti-Ninurta I specifically contrasts himself with Kashtiliash IV. Tukulti-Ninurta I prays to the god Shamash.
O Shamash, Lord, I respected your oath. I feared your greatness, he who does not transgress before you, but I observed your ordinance.
In fact, the text portrays the rebellious king Kashtiliash IV listing his own sins.
So Kashtiliash deliberated with himself. I did not listen to what the Assyrian, Tukulti-Ninurta, but said, I made light of the messenger. I did not conciliate him. I did not accept his favorable intention before. Now I understand how grievous the crimes of my land are become, how numerous its sins.
And even more directly,
many are my wrongdoings before Shamash. Great are my misdeeds. Who is the God that will spare my people from catastrophe? The Assyrian is ever heedful of all the gods.
Another example of this type of text is cited by Dr. Liverani in a psalm to Asher for Tukulti-Ninurta I. The psalm depicts the four nations around Assyria as not only in rebellion, but also as ungrateful to Asher, in spite of all that he had done for them.
The lands of one accord have surrounded your city, Assur with a noose of evil. All of them have come to hate the shepherd whom you name, who administers your peoples, all regions of the earth, for which you had produced benevolent assistance, held you in contempt. And though you extended your protection to them, they rebuffed you and your land. The king for whom you held goodwill made sure to disobey you, and even those whom you treated well unsheathed their weapons against you.
Later, during the reign of Tiglath-Pileser III, mid to late 8th century BCE, a royal inscription concerning military engagement with the people of the land of Aliba states that they
planned sinful deeds in their hearts and planned evil.
From this small sampling of text, we see that the Assyrian king and his people are described as the fearing, observant, reverent worshipers of the god. In contrast, the foreign people groups find themselves under severe attack by the Assyrian army because of their own actions and behaviors. They had disobeyed the gods, ignored their sacred oaths, planned evil in their hearts, and acted sinfully in rebellion. This provided clear justification, even responsibility, on part of the Assyrian king to march his army against these wicked rebels to right the wrongs that they had so irreverently committed. Of course, no historian today would treat the depictions of Assyrian enemies in these texts at face value. To read the internal monologue of the Kassite king Kashtiliash IV, admitting his errant behavior, and then to conclude that Tukulti-Ninurta I was therefore perfectly in the right for waging war against him, well, that would be foolish. These texts were written from a specific vantage point with the particular purpose in mind to provide a justification for Assyria's military conquest and the expansion of the Assyrian state. We cannot simply reconstruct history from these texts and conclude that the Kassites or the people of Aluba were actually wicked and sinful people deserving of such divine judgment. However, this is often how people, specifically Christian apologists, come to the Old Testament. When we read passages about the wickedness of the Canaanites or the sins of the Amorites, we are tempted to simply take the text at face value. The Canaanites must have been evil because that is what text says. But we absolutely cannot approach these passages in this way, just as we cannot merely base our reconstruction of history on the ideologically or theologically motivated writings of the Assyrians. We cannot take the writers of the Hebrew Bible at their word when they describe the actions of their enemies and rivals. This is especially true when the purported events occurred centuries earlier than the time of the writings, as Collins writes.
Okay, we're going to stop there because making good points. How can you go back in time and look at someone's reflection on what took place and then apply it as, oh yeah, it must be true or whatever? The problem is, again, he is not fighting the Bible. He's fighting the apologists. So people that have a shallow understanding of ancient texts will give you very clear-cut answers. Why did that stuff happen? If it even happened, because God was angry with the people because they were misbehaving. So even in the answer, it shows you that it serves a purpose of teaching people what's right and what's wrong, what's moral, what's approved by God. But again, he says, these events could have happened hundreds of years before, which is the documentary hypotheses, or it's even a different type of hypotheses, where they say that the Torah was written by the Babylonian exiles. So if you take that approach, it was like Excalibur. It was legends of the Jews. They were passed down through the generations, and one final editor or author put it all together, and he framed it as the enemies of our people are wicked. They deserve to be destroyed. That makes so much sense to me, that while you're being enslaved by the Assyrians and later the Babylonians, that you would write a text reflecting on the successes of your ancestors against similar kingdoms and similar wicked enemies of your God and yourself, to encourage people to not give up, to encourage them that you had a great history and a dynasty of leaders that got you through very difficult times, and that they, when you got dispossessed from your land, that you look forward to going back to the milk and honey. So if you're not able to break away from religious dogma and look at it from different perspectives, you are going to fall into a lot of the traps that we're discussing. And for him to be so disappointed with Christian apologists that he has to do these projects shows that, again, if that's not what you believe, he says you cannot take theological stories and apply them. You can. That's your right. It's your constitutional right to say, I believe that it happened, and I believe that that's how God rolls. Why does it affect him so much? Does he have a family member that hits him with a Bible and says, you better believe this or you're going to hell? If he does, he needs to come clean. He needs to say, the reason I'm making these videos is because I want to prove to my ancestors that they were backwards and that I'm right. Or I want to have a document for my children so they don't end up believing these crazy ideas. But instead, he now has the gospel. And the gospel is, these texts are wrong, and they're just like any other text where people justify their war. Every war is justified by the individual that partakes of that war. So to hold judgment against the king of Assyria, he saw the other people as wicked, and he killed them, and they saw him as wicked, and they came after him, but he won. So you have to be ignorant to not know that history is written usually by the winners, but the whole claim of the Hebrew scriptures is that the history that is depicted is written by the losers, because throughout the accounts, it's always the underdog that is confronting the king, that it is dealing with stuff. So if there is a segment where they show themselves as conquerors, then you have to think, why are they showing themselves as conquerors, as if we know that they were always the underdog? So they're turning around, and then they're conquerors by the hand of God when they are victims by the hand of the enemy, when possibly they put together these books. So they are projecting their hopes, their wisdom, their desire to be conquerors to these texts. And I have no problem with that. That doesn't take away anything from the text being true in a spiritual sense. What do you think, Tom?
Yeah, I think you hit it right on the head. Also, what he noticed, what I noticed is when he brought it, first off, him bringing up the whole Assyrian ideology in this documentary, I think is a moot point. All it proves is there's similarities amongst Eastern cultures and societies, Semitic peoples, which is understandable. They're neighbors. They're all in the same area. Second off, he says that there's no mention in the Assyrian texts that mentions why these certain groups were found guilty in the sight of this king. And he says the same thing is similar to the Israelites. But that's not true. That just shows his lack of knowledge on the Bible itself and the text, what it says. It does bring an indictment against these people, like I said a couple of minutes ago, in the book of Leviticus. God clearly says that the nation that possesses the land that you're about to go into, they're doing X, Y, and Z, and you're not allowed to do X, Y, and Z. So the very commandments, it's like Hashem gave them an abstract view, something tangible they could see that was being practiced, and a specific group of people of what not to do when they go into this land. So there is an indictment within the very text for that. If any human being walked in a scenario where they saw another human being practicing one of these practices on another human being, whether it be a child or a woman, especially, or the elderly, any man that has any type of morals and ethics, I don't care what your religion is, would try to intervene in those scenarios, even if it caused you to have to unalive somebody to protect the innocent in that situation. So it's really unjust in the presentation of what he's doing, because now he's got steeped over into the realm. I'm gonna judge favorably and say he was ignorant of that fact. But even if he was, but if he's not, now he's kind of went over into the realm of being dishonest.
Theologians have usually assumed the validity of the biblical viewpoint. Often the conquest is said to be justified by the decadence of the Canaanites, a judgment for which there is little objective evidence.
It's all hyperbolic. I have learned to keep hammers away from my four-year-old. When he has a hammer in his hand, everything becomes a nail. In my experience with debates about the Bible, this is also the case with the concept of hyperbole in the hands of many fundamentalists and online Christian apologists. Once they get a hold of it, every incident of objectionable violence in the Old Testament becomes hyperbole. While there is clearly hyperbolic language in the Hebrew Bible, as throughout most of the ancient Near Eastern literature, placing every description of violence and genocide into the same category, or expecting hyperbole to do away with the problems that such passages create, is both simplistic and naive. In this section, we will look at several passages that, from a literary standpoint, hinge on the absolute nature of the command by Yahweh for the children of Israel to destroy all living things. The point is here not to argue against the existence of hyperbole in the Old Testament passages, but rather that there are many narratives that rise and fall on the non-hyperbolic intent of the story. Perhaps the most oft-cited publication in apologetics discussions of the Hebrew Bible is Paul Copan's book, Is God a Moral Monster? Making Sense of the Old Testament God. Relying on the work of scholars like Lawson Younger, Copan, and others attempt to downplay the severity of Yahweh's command of violence and genocide by noting that a type of ancient Near Eastern war rhetoric was likely employed to greater or lesser degrees. In passages like the conquest narrative of Joshua, for example, Copan writes,
"Some might accuse Joshua of being misleading or of getting it wrong. Not at all. He was speaking the language that everyone in his day would have understood. Rather than trying to deceive, Joshua was just saying he had fairly well trounced the enemy."
Glad he brought up Joshua. I'm glad he's in Joshua now, because we see an instance where the very people that he was told to destroy were given mercy. Joshua even made a covenant with a group of them because they dressed up differently. And then honored that covenant. If they were so evil and immoral, why would Joshua make a covenant with these people that deceived him? And when he found out, he still honored his word. He didn't destroy them. I mean, it's like, I think what happens is these people make these hit pieces, or these scholars, they get blinded by an ideology and they want this narrative to fit so badly. They push it and push it in hopes that people will bite onto it. And then when they do, it's the age-old trick in the book. You feed off the ignorance of other people. This is why I say, I've yet to see this man interview a rabbi. What is the problem with that? I don't understand the problem with that. Is it maybe because you're fearful that this rabbi might have a little bit more information that you've never heard before, to add a little bit more context? Maybe that's the case. But I would just say that it's not what, in the scientific world, I'm going to meet him where he's at. In the scientific world, when you're looking at to come to a conclusion in a matter, you have the scientific method and you follow the evidence. But he's not following the evidence. He's using the evidence like a cafeteria. He's picking and choosing what he wants. And I've heard him say that even about Christianity. Christians, they pick and choose. Oh, au contraire, you're doing the same thing. You're picking information that fits your narrative and you're pushing it, because you're not considering all the other evidence. There's no archaeological evidence to validate. We found copper scroll tablets at the bottom of Mount Ebal, just like it says in the text. We found Here recently, we have discoveries archaeologically that validate King David and Solomon. We found seals from Solomon. We have ancient writings from other nations that represent King Hezekiah. We have so to say archaeology and history does not validate any of these stances is completely dishonest. It's completely dishonest.